Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
When General Motors ran into financial trouble recently, Chief Executive Officer Rick Wagoner accepted a 50% cut in his salary. Other major corporations are linking things like bonus pay or stock options to how well the company performs. Should such a policy apply to arts organizations? This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. A recent article by Wall Street Journal reporter Jacob Hale Russell suggested that some major orchestras have increased the salaries of their top earners, even as they face sluggish ticket and subscription sales. Jacob Russell joins us in the studio today. Jacob, welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Also with us is Jesse Rosen, the Vice President and Chief Program Officer of the American Symphony Orchestra League. Jesse, thanks for coming back in.
You're welcome. Hi, John.
Jacob, let me start with your thesis, which seems to be that orchestras and opera companies may be the only institutions that actually reward their executives with pay increases while the institution is suffering financially. Is that basically how it seems to be working?
In many cases, it's not across the board, but we went through 40 arts organizations and looked at their tax filings for the last few years. And over a five-year period between 1999 and 2004, at many of them we found that the music director or the general director had received a pay raise while the ticket sales or other revenues for that organization had decreased.
Now, you give a number of examples, but the most striking of them is probably the case of Daniel Barenboim, the conductor of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra.
That's one of the ones that jumped out. His salary is around $2 million, and it has increased almost 70% over the last 5 years. Yet program sales for that orchestra fell by about 8%, mm-hmm. And sales were down 5.7% last year.
So sales going down, people are wringing their hands, classical music, no one's coming, no one's supporting, and meanwhile the conductor's salary's going up substantially over the course of this period of time. Now, you focus primarily on conductors in the article. What about, you know, the CEOs, the presidents of these various orchestras, the performing arts centers in this country, dance companies? I mean, there's a whole broad array of people that you could have been looking at.
That's right, and in many cases that same pattern would have been observed with them. One of the things about conductor salaries, of course, is that because at the large orchestras they are between $1 and $2 million, they tend to stand out more than a typical executive director salary, which would normally be in the neighborhood of $300,000 to $600,000 at those same organizations.
Mm-hmm. But if you're talking about the people who run the Kennedy Center, Lincoln Center, you know, the big performing arts centers here in the United States, are we talking about, you know, seven-figure salaries, less than that?
In most cases, for the arts organization, the performing arts presenters, they're less than seven figures. They're in the mid to high six figures.
All right. Jesse, you're with the American Symphony Orchestra League. I mean, you must have seen these numbers. Daniel Barenboim's pay at 1.9, Lauren Mizell, 1.9 million, James Levine, also 1.9, Michael Tilson-Thomas in San Francisco making nearly 1.6 million. Are they worth that in the current economic and artistic climate?
The short answer is absolutely, that they're worth every penny. And frankly, if they were twice as much, they'd be worth that too. I think the thing I want to distinguish is the roles. I think there's some roles to unbundle here. And the music director of an orchestra is not the equivalent of the CEO of a corporation. The closest thing to the CEO would be the executive director in the case of an orchestra. And so the music director is not the person upon whom the revenue generation sinks or swims, or the contributed income sinks or swims. They are hired principally for what their contributions are as an artist. And, you know, if you think maybe the equivalent of what the music director is and the musicians are is like the collection of a museum. It is the core, the essence of what the institution is. And I don't think a museum, if upon a period of hard time, sold off its collection or stopped paying for air conditioning because it was expensive and risked the deterioration of the collection, that would not be a strategy deemed to be an effective one for dealing with a tough environment. And similarly, to think about reducing fees for the talent in an orchestra as a strategy for dealing with audience development or funding challenges, it's kind of a non sequitur. The two things have nothing to do with each other.
Right. Well, I guess, from a musician's standpoint, when there are hard times, musicians have been asked occasionally for give backs. And if they see the salary of the conductor is not giving back, that sets up a certain dissonance as well.
Yeah. I think in most cases, you may not find percentage point to percentage point tracking of how that goes, but I think it would definitely be the exception of a concessionary contract for the musicians at a period where the music director's contract was going up dramatically. And, one of the things that struck me in the information in the Wall Street Journal article, particularly in the chart, when you look at the growth in what's referred to as, I think, performance or program revenue over this 5-year period, what you actually see are some very, I think, strikingly positive figures of growth over a period that I think, admittedly, for anyone in arts and entertainment and culture, has been one of the toughest periods we recall. And, the most dramatic, of course, is the LA Philharmonic with a 78% increase over that period with a flat increase in growth of the music director's contract.
So conductor Esa-Pekka Salonen's contract, basically his salary stayed flat.
Right.
Meanwhile, the orchestra with a 78% increase. Now, Jacob, you mentioned in the article or in this chart that much of that is due to the almost unnatural amount of publicity the orchestra got when Disney Hall opened. So it was to be expected there would be a big push there, I guess.
That's right. That's certainly part of it. I think another factor that these numbers can't show is that in many cases, music directors' contracts are negotiated several years out in advance. And so unlike a Fortune 500 company, it's harder to adjust those salaries on a year-to-year basis as the orchestra's performance change.
Okay. Now, Jacob, your article in the Wall Street Journal, raises this question of, in tough times, do you want to be paying a conductor close to $2 million? But it strikes me that these are times where a second-rate utility infielder is making $2 million, where, Britney Spears is making $23 million last year, Tiger Woods making $80 million. I mean, when we think of all the other fields of entertainment out there, that $2 million salary suddenly seems pretty paltry.
I think many people would say that's true. I think the people who would criticize the raises would be those who are concerned about declining audience numbers at many orchestras across the country, an overall average decline in audience numbers, declines in subscriptions, and wondering if orchestras need to step back and think more seriously about how they're spending their money.
Right. Now, Jesse, you pointed out that the conductor is not the person upon whom all the revenue is based, that he or she is there for artistic purposes. But in fact, a lot of music directors now are expected to be heavily involved in fundraising and stuff, and you could in fact make a case that if revenue is off, that the music director perhaps isn't doing that part of the job so well.
I don't think so.
Well, Daniel Barenboim's pulling out of Chicago in part because he's sick of all the fundraising that's involved.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's true. I think that's an anomaly, and I think
which Barenboim pulling out, or
I think the framing of the challenge in Chicago of Barenboim leaving because of the demands on him to play a greater role in fundraising and institutional support. It's becoming anachronistic, which is to say that I think that the idea of a music director exclusively devoted to rehearsals and concerts is fading away in America. And I think it's an appropriate adaptation that's going on in the field. And for sure, music directors who can engage with the public and convey a sense of connectivity to their community, whether it's through showing up at fundraising receptions or speaking to the audience. This is becoming part and parcel to the role. I think it's a progressive development in the field. Ultimately, though, the test for the quality of a music director is going to be on the quality of the music making. And mm-hmm. I think an orchestra may, and often does, look to those non-musical characteristics. But when push comes to shove, it's the quality of musical experience that happens on the stage. And that's still going to be the driving consideration for orchestras.
We are speaking with Jacob Hale Russell, who wrote this article recently in the Wall Street Journal about salaries of arts administrators, most notably conductors, during financially difficult times, and also Jesse Rosen, the vice president and chief program officer of the American Symphony Orchestra League. Now, Jesse, just in the context of what you just said, in the biggest orchestras, the highest profile conducting openings when they occur, they tend to be filled by people with really, you know, a lot of name recognition within that community. And the thinking seems to be, we have a couple of people here who are all great at making music and would be great in the artistic role, but this person with the name recognition is going to raise our visibility among potential donors, help us with, you know, fundraising and stuff. So that also seems to be something that needs to be kind of weighed into the equation of, you know, how those decisions are made.
I think so. Part of what I see happening, though, is that I think in orchestras there's a growing recognition that there's a body of work that has to be undertaken that has to do with the public role of the orchestra. And there's a tension in loading all of that up onto a musician that we call the music director, who's it's just an accident of luck if they happen to be good at that stuff. And some of them are, and some of them cultivate it, and we have some wonderful examples in this country. Michael Tilson Thomas, Maren Alsop, Leonard Slatkin, Robert Spano, you know, it goes on and on. Mm-hmm. And it's really a wonderful evolution that we're seeing in the field. Yet at the same time, you see a phenomenon like at the Philadelphia Orchestra, which has engaged somebody that they call an animateur, which is a term from English orchestras, and it's somebody whose job is only and exclusively to look after how the orchestra communicates to the public. And that person, you know, not only looks at family concerts and youth concerts and community engagement work, but also looks at the subscription series. And I saw one of their programs recently where Christoph Eschenbach came out on stage in a regular subscription program, holding in his hand his baton and a microphone as though they were melded together. Mm-hmm. And he came out and he conducted and he talked, followed by the principal percussionist who invited the audience to come and talk with the section after they performed a concerto.
So taking a little bit of a more contemporary view of what an audience might expect from a concert experience, as opposed to sitting politely and silently.
Exactly. And right, institutional thing that's interesting is the recognition that the conductor can't do it all.
Right.
He shouldn't always have to do it all.
Okay. Well, I want to follow up on that because, you know, talking on stage can either be a lot more of the same or it can be something a little different, depending on, of course, on who the conductor is. But you mentioned Michael Tilson Thomas. In the background is Michael Tilson Thomas and the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra, and a recording that the orchestra has released on its own label. And we'll hear a little bit of this, and as we do, we will open up the phones and ask you folks, what do you think? Are classical conductors underpaid, overpaid? Is it about right? How tightly tied should their salaries be to the way the orchestras go? What does it say about what we value in this society when a conductor of the top drawer makes $2 million a year and a backup infielder makes about the same? Our number is 212-264-7483. That's 212-264-7483. We We are talking about some of the salaries in the arts world and kind of focusing a little bit on the pay given to some of the most visible of artists in the classical music field, namely conductors. Speaking with reporter Jacob Hale Russell, who wrote the article recently in the Wall Street Journal that has occasioned our conversation, and Jesse Rosen, the Vice President and Chief Program Officer of the American Symphony Orchestra League. You know, it's funny, conductors used to make a lot of money, Jacob, on issuing recordings. This record by Michael Tilson Thomas and the musicians of the San Francisco Symphony is something they don't make a penny on unless it sells enough to be a profitable venture, at which point they start to divvy up the proceeds. So it seems like the model is changing rapidly in response to the demands of the marketplace.
It certainly is, and orchestras are trying to adapt to the ways in which those are changing. I think record contracts having been something that orchestras have struggled a lot with in the last 10 years, and then a number of new strategies like the San Francisco one that are looking at ways that they can actually bring record contracts back into their primary income sources.
Mm-hmm. Let's take some phone calls. Our number is 212-264-7483. That's 264-7483. And, of course, you can also email us, soundcheck@wnyc.org. Let's start with Nancy in Larchmont. Welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you. I just wanted to point out that we're not only talking about prices for conductors, but also prices for soloists, which are extremely high.
Good point.
In a declining audience environment. And I'd also like to say that these conductors are on the back end of a supply and demand curve. They all want to conduct at the New York Philharmonic and the Boston Symphony, and I think they could be paid a lot less, and still it could be very competitive to have those top jobs.
Well, a couple of things there. I mean, Jacob, if I can refer to your article, the fact is if they do cut the salaries here in America, there are orchestras in Europe that are more than happy to lure them away with a lot more cash.
Europe and Japan, particularly, actually.
What about soloists, though? I mean, there are soloists whose fees are well into six figures for, you know, a night's work. How can you even recoup that if you're an orchestra relying on ticket sales?
A lot of orchestra administrators, in the context of working on the story, talked about how they've been rethinking the role of the soloist. Because in many cases, when you're paying a really high fee for a soloist, you don't end up recouping the costs. You might sell at your hall, but in general, the business of orchestras is not one where really any concert is going to make more money than it costs to produce. The issue is, of course, that orchestras also think they have an obligation to present the best soloist, the best music, to give their audiences an experience that won't necessarily make money, but is serving the broader point of that orchestra.
So, Jesse, I mean, you're with the American Symphony Orchestra League, but you must be aware then of what's happening in the Far East and in Europe. And you know, we can't just say, all right, let's cool it with the soloist fees, because then you don't see them anymore. They're off where the money is.
Yeah, I mean, it's the comment about supply and demand, I actually think it's reverse from Nancy's comment, which, particularly with respect to music directorships, usually when there's an opening at a very large orchestra, the number of potential candidates is very, very few. And the orchestra's competing against fees and salaries from Europe and Asia, which generally are higher than is what's available to us here. Lifestyle issues are very important. And so the supply and demand works actually against the institution and in favor of the conductor. And in terms of soloists, I think, again, essentially it's a question about artistry and the value of the artistry. And I think it becomes problematic sometimes when there's disappointment, when there's a large financial investment in an artist and the artist doesn't deliver. And then you say, well, we spent all this money, and is this all we get? And that happens. You know, artists change and evolve and all of that.
But what happens when you pay a lot of money and the artist does give you a stellar performance and it's worth every penny, and you take a bath on the series of concerts that you've just presented?
That's art. I mean, that's the world that we're in. And obviously you cannot sustain an institution if that's all you do all the time.
Right.
But we're actually in business to do that some of the time.
Okay. Let's see if we can squeeze in another call. Daniel in Brooklyn.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi. I believe orchestra conductors are grossly overpaid. Now, you compare their salaries to the utility infielder on a major league ball team.
Right.
The utility infielder represents a ball team that is making fortunes of money, and they could afford to pay them more because they are doing well financially, the ball teams themselves. Whereas when the orchestras do not do well, they are reaching into the pockets of their funders and those who visit them to pay these gross salaries. Now, there's one other point. There are many conductors who are excellent and never get a chance to conduct because the few conductors we have monopolize the industry. There are not enough good orchestras available, so the few conductors monopolize it, and others stand by the sidelines waiting for years and years before they become recognized. An example of that would be Leonard Bernstein, who got his name because he conducted by accident when someone got sick.
When Bruno Walter was
brought to the attention of the public.
That's right. When Bruno Walter got sick.
Otherwise, it may have taken years or never when he would be known.
Well, and, you know, we also have the case, all good points, Daniel. We also have the case of the conductors with multiple music directorships. So that's another matter altogether. But, you know, Jacob, I mean, Daniel makes a good point. You know, the utility infielder is playing on a team that has millions of seats being filled in a given season. Orchestras are not working on that scale at all.
Well, I think part of the problem is just that orchestras don't see themselves as being in the same business as a sports team. They see themselves as serving different purposes, musical purposes. I also think there's a risk that many orchestras think if they couldn't attract a top-notch conductor or top-notch soloists, they would also lose musicians. And if they lost musicians, they would lose audience members, and it would create sort of a vicious cycle. And that may be a way in which orchestras differ from sports teams.
One of many, of course. Jacob Hale Russell is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Jesse Rosen is vice president and chief program officer of the American Symphony Orchestra League. Thanks to everyone who's called. Jacob and Jesse, thanks to both of you for coming in this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
This is Soundcheck, and in a moment, he's the heir to a 400-year-old music tradition, and he's bringing it into the 21st century. Sitar master Nishat Khan performs live in our studio next. Thanks for listening to Soundcheck from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Every day we dig into what's happening in music, and you can hear everything we do and check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. All of this is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.